This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. For movie fans, this is the time of year for new holiday releases and end-of-the-year 10 best lists. Our film critic John Powers will give us his picks for the best of the year a little later, but first we're going to talk about the new movies that are opening for the holidays. John, let's start with Ali, which is opening Christmas Day. It's been very heavily advertised. Will Smith stars as Muhammad Ali. How is it?
It's actually pretty good. I had some doubts about the film in advance, because even though Michael Mann made it, and he's an interesting, talented filmmaker, there's something about biographical films that tends to make things extremely boring. But what Mann has done is he's taken a 10-year period of Ali's life, basically from 1964 to 1974, the time from shortly before his fight with Sonny Liston, in which Cassius Clay won the title and became Muhammad Ali, to the period where he beat George Foreman in Zaire, and uses that as a way not only of showing you Ali's life, which is rather familiar, but of expanding out to offer a portrait of black culture during that same period. A portrait that includes everything from Sam Cooke, who was a friend of Ali, through the black Muslim movement, through the anti-war part of black life that Ali came to represent, and then finally to the sort of pan-Africanist ideals of Ali in the fight in Zaire.
How does Will Smith do as Muhammad Ali?
He's actually rather blank. I think they must have made some choice that they weren't going to try to take you inside Ali. He's too iconic in a way, and I think they didn't want to try to dramatize him. So more or less, it's an external performance, and deliberately so. It's rather convincing much of the time. You know, the odd thing about it is that Smith, who's so great at being light and exuberant, doesn't quite capture the lightness and exuberance of Ali. He captures many of the other things, so he actually moves around the ring very well. He's bulked up effectively. He's very good at being sober and complicated, but what he's not so good at is being delightful.
I think a lot of TV and theatrical movies that are set in the recent past have this fake picture postcard look about them, and a lot of the cast looks like they've assembled for a theme party where you're supposed to come dressed like it's the 60s or the 70s. Does Ali have that kind of fake look to it in terms of, you know, the costumes and people's hairdos?
No, it actually doesn't. I think that it's probably, like most Hollywood films, a bit too precise in its art direction and costuming, which is to say that everyone is dressed a little bit too much perfectly in character. But what the director, Michael Mann, has very skillfully done is show you the kinds of places that you never really have seen in movies before, or at least I've never seen in movies before, so that you see the kind of small hotels that an African-American would have stayed in the 1960s, even if he's an extremely famous African-American. It'll actually show you the kinds of houses or apartments where Muhammad Ali would live. And I haven't really seen that before, and at that level, it's extremely interesting. What you don't get are the kinds of things that you used to get on, say, Starsky and Hutch, where with the character of Huggy Bear wearing, you know, purely extravagant costumes and everybody going, wow. There's nothing of that. I mean, the story is the center here, and the background and costuming and all the rest is very, very discreet.
Sounds like you're recommending the film.
I am recommending the film. I mean, it's disappointing in some ways, I should say. It's a cold film, and I think somehow it doesn't build in quite the way I would like it to. So at the end, I didn't think I'd gotten all that much by the end. Yet, strange as I was watching it, I was engrossed at every moment watching the film.
Now, In the Bedroom is opening in more cities on Christmas. And this has already won the L.A. Film Critics Award for Best Film. You're part of that group, John. And
yes,
the New York Film Critics voted the two leads, Tom Wilkinson and Sissy Spacek, Best Actor and Actress of the Year. What did you think of the movie?
I think it's a good film that perhaps has been a little bit overrated. And I don't mean that as a negative thing. I think it is one of the better films of the year. And it's an extraordinarily good first film by the director, Todd Field. I guess my thought about the film is that it's the kind of small, humane film that people are going to especially like in the aftermath of September 11th. It's a story about a couple who seem to be happily married, who suffer a great personal loss in their life, a death, and more or less what that does to their relationship and to their sense of justice in the universe. It has two excellent performances, one by Sissy Spacek, and in particular one by the actor Tom Wilkinson, who many of you might remember as the unemployed foreman from The Full Monty, who gives probably the performance of his life as a father who loses a child and as a husband who feels that he's losing his wife, who's very angry with him when the child is lost.
Without giving away the ending, John, I was wondering if, for all the realism and subtlety of the movie, if the ending seemed kind of false to you.
It did seem false to me. I think that's one reason why I don't think it's quite so good as people are saying, is that one of the problems with films as opposed to short stories, and this is based on a short story by André Debus, is that films tend to need a little bit more of a wallop at the end, whereas one of the great things about short stories is they can be more muted. And I think that what happens in the film of In the Bedroom is that you need to build up to something slightly larger and more dramatic. It did ring false to me. It's not so much the events of it, but even in some of the ways that it's photographed and paced, it made it seem like a little bit more of a thriller by the end than the character study that had been earlier.
Let's look at Lord of the Rings. Did you go into this as a Hobbit fan?
Well, I had read the books when I was quite young. And so I guess at that level I was a Hobbit fan, although it must have been, you know, several decades since I've actually wanted to read about an elf. So at that level, I probably didn't go in. And I'm one of those people, like many people in the audience, who when I see names like Frodo, my heart kind of sinks. I like, you know, films where people are named Jim. And so I would say that when I went into the theater, I wasn't completely convinced that I wanted to be there. And for the first 20 minutes, I really thought, I'm in trouble. The film is 3 hours long. It was 20 minutes in, and I was looking at my watch and thinking, I'm now caught in Middle Earth with these little people with hairy feet for hours and hours and hours. But a strange thing happened about 20 or 30 minutes in, which is the story suddenly kicks into gear, and the film becomes extremely absorbing. Probably two of the 3 hours are extremely good. You know, they're moving and fast-paced with absolutely spectacular production design. You know, one of the funny things about the film is it's one of the most expensive projects in the history of filmmaking. It's actually a trilogy of films made all at the same time, and the combined cost was $270 million. And when you hear a number like that, it seems incredible that anyone could spend that much on a film. Yet when you watch Lord of the Rings, you can actually see where the money went. I mean, it is visually sumptuous, incredibly elaborate, extraordinarily precise in all its details of creating an alternative universe. So between the production design, the extremely good acting, fine directing, it's actually a good film.
How would you compare it to the Harry Potter movie?
I think the Harry Potter movie had some of the same limitations, which is to say that the fans of both Potter and Tolkien are incredibly literal-minded. They don't want you to change anything. So you're stuck with the fact that any change you make gets you in trouble. Both were caught that way. The difference between the two is that the Harry Potter film is essentially a corporate product, and the film of Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Rings, which is its actual title, it's the Lord of the Rings, the Fellowship of the Ring, is quite different. It was made by a New Zealand director named Peter Jackson, who shot it in his home country, and it's an extremely personal film. You actually, when you're watching it, you can tell that one guy made it, one guy's imagination is at work in it, and it has a kind of homegrown, organic quality, whereas Harry Potter feels as though it was put together partly with marketing ideas in mind, partly out of fear that the kids who read the books won't like the version you're doing. And so there's a very different feeling to the two films.
Let's move to The Shipping News, which is based on the Annie Prue novel of the same name. That's going to be opening in a lot of cities for the holidays. It'll be opening in more cities in the weeks to come. Did you read the novel before seeing the movie?
Well, I'd read the novel when it came out, and I didn't go back to reread it. But yes, I had read it. And, you know, what was striking about the novel was the language in particular. It wasn't so much the story of the novel, which is about a sort of schlubby guy named Coyle's redemption as he goes from being one of life's losers to regaining confidence, going back to his ancestral home in Newfoundland and finding a new life. That part of the story hadn't struck me so much as the way that E. Annie Prue had told the story. In the film adaptation, what's lost is that narrative voice. And so what you have is a slightly wan adaptation of a story that looks much less good when you see it on screen than it felt when you read it in the book.
Kevin Spacey's the lead. How is he?
Kevin Spacey is making a serious career mistake. I don't usually give career advice. You know, it's not my job. But for some reason, ever since American Beauty, he's decided that he wants to be lovable. And the problem is that no one wants to love Kevin Spacey for being lovable. You know, we want to love him for being a jerk. I mean, if you look at the great Kevin Spacey roles, he's always ironic and nasty. And then maybe at the end, as in L.A. Confidential, you'll discover that there's a bit of humanity beneath the smugness and the irony and the jerkiness. But ever since American Beauty, he's begun casting himself in roles where he's playing, you know, wounded masculinity, the sensitive male. And this is perhaps the most extreme example of that, where he's even playing a sensitive kind of dumb guy. And I think that no one in America thinks of Kevin Spacey as a sensitive, wounded kind of dumb guy.
So is this one you think we should avoid, or is it just worth going to but not great?
It's. I guess you could go. I mean, okay. I try to be fair in these things, Terry. You know, which is, I mean, why I talk to people who've seen it, and I think the general sense is the same sense I have, which is it's a rather disappointing film, and one of the major problems with the film is Spacey.
Film critic John Powers is my guest. We're talking about movies opening for the holidays. John, I'm going to ask you to just put in a word for a film that you recently reviewed, The Royal Tenenbaums, but this will be opening in a lot of cities for the Christmas holidays. So tell us why you liked it so much.
Yes. Well, I think it's actually one of the films this year that is both funny and touching at the same time, often in the same scene at the same moment. It's a story about a bunch of kids who were once geniuses who aren't any longer, and they now have to come to terms with their father, played by Gene Hackman. And what's good about this film is it captures the weird dynamics of family life in a way that you don't normally see in films. And at the same time, it's got very offbeat sense of humor and this peculiar ability to make you laugh at something while you're feeling really sad at the same time. The reason I want to mention it is that this is a film that's been largely neglected by critics groups and won't have the big advertising budget of films like Ali or Lord of the Rings. Yet it's a really, really good film, one of the best films of the year, and I don't want to see it neglected.
Why do you think that The Royal Tenenbaums didn't make it on more 10 best lists, or at least not yet?
I think The Royal Tenenbaums is a tricky film, and that many people are judging it in relation to other things than the film itself. So some will say, oh, it's like a Salinger story, and then it's not like a Salinger story, and then they think it's a failed Salinger story. Or they'll say, oh, it's like The Magnificent Ambersons by Orson Welles, but it's not like The Magnificent Ambersons, so therefore it's not a successful movie. I think the film makes a kind of demand on you that films don't often do, which is it asks you to think and feel different things from moment to moment, and that it kind of sneaks up on you with its emotions. And I think a lot of people, when they see the film, because it's got a lot of jokes and sort of whimsical humor at the beginning, don't grasp that the film's arc keeps getting deeper and deeper and deeper. And so they are sort of stuck on the first part and think, oh, this is a precious comedy. And they never adjust to the fact that part of the structure of the film is to seem exuberant and buoyant and then gradually change into something else.
Anything you think we should avoid over the holidays?
Well, there are a lot of things to avoid over the holidays. I think that I wouldn't go to see The Majestic, the Jim Carrey film, which has been described by one critic as the most boring film ever made. That's probably not true, but it's one of these in a way, that would actually make it sound too interesting. I mean, to see the most boring film ever made is something you might actually want to do. I think that the film that probably will get the best reviews that I don't think is very good is the film A Beautiful Mind, starring Russell Crowe as a mathematician named John Nash, who has a schizophrenic break. From reading the early reviews, most of the critics think that it's an extremely good film. It got a lot of Golden Globe nominations. And the truth is, Russell Crowe is very, very good in the film. He's one of the best actors working anywhere in the world right now. And he's extraordinarily good as a brilliant guy who more or less has problems with personal demons that intrude into his life in ways that none of us normally could possibly imagine. But the film is extremely flat and uninteresting and takes what I think one of the most interesting stories I've ever read and turns it into an obvious inspirational saga. It's sort of the math version of Shine. Now, for a lot of people to say that might seem like an inducement. So if you liked Shine and want to see the math version of that, you probably should race out to see A Beautiful Mind. Since I didn't like Shine, and at least in Shine the guy played the piano rather than just thinking about math, I think that you would probably be wise to avoid it if you didn't like Shine.
Oh, count me in on that one. All right. Well, John, thank you for reviewing some Christmas movies opening for the holidays. And in a few minutes, we'll talk about your 10 best list.
Okay.
John Powers is Fresh Air's film critic, as well as media columnist and executive editor of LA Weekly. He'll be back in the second half of the show. This is Fresh Air.